Welcome to the Nassau Marshall History Podcast. In this series, we will examine the Imaging X-ray Polarimetry Explorer, or IXPE. For this first podcast, I caught up with IXPE's principal investigator, Dr. Martin Weisskopf. Dr. Weisskopf details some of the history of polarimetry and provides an overview of the current experiment.
First, let me define IXPE. It's a nice set of letters. It's the Imaging X-ray Polarimetry Explorer. And it's a mission that was selected for the Small Explorer program to launch in November of 2020. And we're currently in the Phase B of that mission. And its origins go back a long, long way to my start in X-ray astronomy back in 1969 at Columbia University, where I went first as a postdoc. And we flew several sounding rockets and flew the first X-ray polarimeters, that is, devices to measure the polarization of X-rays coming from astronomical sources. And we had some small successes. We did the first polarization measurements in definitive ones in 1971 on a big sounding rocket that was launched from Wallops Island. And we measured the average polarization of the Crab Nebula and its pulsar all together and proved that the X-ray emission was due to synchrotron radiation. That was still in some doubt in those days. So it was kind of really neat. And then we flew another polarimeter on an orbiting solar observatory, OSO-8. Again, the same group at Columbia, and we did several other experiments. OSO-8 had two problems. It was one of those missions that had several different pointing directions. And so your experiment might not be pointed where you want it to at the appropriate time, and we were quite limited in what we could do. But we repeated the Crab measurement, and that was measured to 20 sigma, so it was, no question. And set some very important upper limits to some of the other bright sources at the time, but no positive results. Then for a number of reasons, polarimetry throughout the world lagged. The group at Columbia, I came here to Marshall in 77. Together with the group at Columbia, we proposed for and were selected to fly a polarimeter on a Russian mission, a Russian spacecraft, the first Spectrum X Gamma mission. And that polarimeter was built and calibrated. That mission was also not ideal for polarimetry because there were several detectors in the sharing the focus, and either one or the other would be used. And the first year's observing plan had 11 days set aside for polarimetry. It's a problem on trying to do polarimetry on a Christmas tree mission, but polarization measurements are very difficult because, like spectroscopy, what's happening is that all of the flux, very rare that all of the flux from a source will be polarized. So, a large polarization may be 5%. So 90% of the flux you get from the source is useless. So you're only looking at 5% of the, so whereas if you were doing imaging, it's 100% of the flux from the source to make an image. But if you want to do polarimetry, it's all of a sudden dependent on how strongly polarized. In most cases, we don't think it's going to be very strongly polarized. It's still very interesting, but not strongly polarized. So it's difficult. It's like spectroscopy, where you have a large continuous X-ray emission and some little line. So most of the energy is not in that line, and so you need more observing time. And that doesn't go well when everybody else wants to do their observing, and time allocation committees in their infinite wisdom do things. It didn't matter because the Soviet Union collapsed. in 89, and so the mission was scrapped. And moving forward in the mid-90s, here at Marshall, Brian Ramsey and his colleague at the time, Robert Austin, who's no longer here, developed a technique, different way of doing polarization measurements that looked very promising. And that was to, based on the following physics, so when an X-ray comes into a gas and ionizes the atom that it interacts with, there's a photoelectron, so-called, that comes off in that interaction, and it starts to travel in the direction of the polarization vector. Then it kind of rattles around and ionizes some more, and the track looks like a question mark or something, but it's that initial direction that counts. And Brian developed an approach to measuring the electron track, imaging that track so you could look at the polarization. Around the year 2000 in Italy, to our current colleagues on IXPE, Ronaldo Bellazzini and Enrico Costa developed a variation of that Brian's detector that would work at much lower energies. Brian's detector was designed to work in the tens of kilovolts, and they developed a very, very beautiful imaging detector to do these track recognition, track measurements, and image the track, and therefore be able to say which way the polarization vector of any single event was, and then you average them all up, and if it averages to zero, it's unpolarized. If it averages up to one direction, then it's 100% polarized. And they developed this detector in 2000, have been developing it ever since, and that is the detector that we are using on IXPE. And that's it has one of the reasons, many reasons, that we were selected, but one of the things that this allows us to do that no other experiment that people are talking about can do is also do imaging polarimetry. So if we have an extended object, we can do polarization measurements as a function of position, depending, of course, on the angular resolution of the telescope and the detector effects. For IXPE, that's going to be 30 arc seconds. And Marshall is building the telescopes, and the Italians are building the detectors. They're contributing that. And so it's a beautiful marriage because we built telescopes of this kind before. In fact, amusingly enough, we delivered for the second incarnation of Spectrum X a few years ago. We delivered 8 X-ray telescopes for that Russian mission, which hopefully will launch next year. It should launch next year, and we will also get some participation in data here at Marshall, and those are the kinds of things that played together. Our X-ray optics work that has been going on in addition to our work supporting Chandra has been a mainstream of what we do and a reason why we exist and why we get selected. We're flying X-ray optics on several different rocket experiments for Berkeley and Goddard, MIT. We were just about to do something with MIT. We delivered those optics to Russia. We're going to be building optics for IXPE, and we have a major program trying to develop high-resolution, lightweight X-ray optics for future missions, for example, the successor to Chandra, which is currently called Lynx.
What was the proposal process like for IXPE?
So we first proposed this mission for the Small Explorer opportunity in 2000. Let's see, the proposals were due either, I think they were due January 2007, and we first proposed this in 2000, so we submitted the proposal in 2006. The same group of people together, Ball Aerospace, Italians, and us, and we lost to another polarimeter called GEMS at the time, which was a Goddard experiment. Subsequently, GEMS was canceled when it could not pass its what they call KBPC, or confirmation after phase B. We're in phase B right now, where next year we're going to get to that KBPC, where we have to be confirmed to move ahead. The new Explorer opportunity came out, I think it came out in 2005 with the proposals, 2015 with the proposals due in 2016, and that was a two-step process. First, there were everybody proposed, and then they selected three experiments for phase A, and we were one of the three. Goddard, again, the same polarimeter was the second one, and then there was an experiment from infrared experiment from JPL was the third. And in January of this year, 2017, they announced that we had won that competition. And we're into phase B and looking for, we see no reason why we won't be selected. One of the interesting things, I think it's very interesting to NASA people, especially managers, and is that part of our proposal was an independent cost estimate that we hired Aerospace Corporation to do. And most of people in NASA know that aerospace cost estimates in aerospace is extremely conservative. And their cost estimate was lower than our cost. And of course, one of the major selection criteria is cost risk. And of course, we had, you know, numerous other things to both to argue our case why we weren't a cost risk. But I personally think that this was a real important input, which I think just showed that, you know, we have this, you know, we have this mission under control. Spacecraft has no heroic requirements. The detectors have been built and tested in the laboratory. The optics have been built and tested in the laboratory. You know, it's just a matter of doing it and putting it all together. So we're very confident.
Tell us a little about the hardware and how it differs from previous work done by Brian Ramsey's group here at Marshall.
So the XP detectors, we have full development of those detectors in the laboratory, and they've been laboratory tested. They've been shaked, rattled, and rolled. Lifetime tested. We've had one running for 3 years. That particular detector has not flown, but what it is a proportional counter. And proportional counters have flown for decades. In fact, they were the earliest detectors that ever flew. Combination of all of the development testing together with the fact that in conceptually it's nothing new, we have no concerns about that. All the other polarization methods were quite different. The first successful ones, the one on OSO 8, was based on a crystal polarimeter. So X-rays come in at 45 degrees to a crystal, Bragg crystal, and depending on how the polarization vector is aligned with respect to the surface, if it's parallel to the surface or perpendicular to the surface, it'll either reflect or not reflect. And so then you rotate around the line of sight, and if the there's strong polarization, you'll see a modulation. So it was very different, and then just the reflected ray was just detected by some detector in those early days, a big proportional counter, just saying yes or no. Brian's approach is conceptually similar to IXPE, but not the same at all, right? What Brian did was to, based on the physics of what goes on in the particular gases mixture that he used, he created ultraviolet light from the particles becoming ionized and imaged with a telescope and a CCD onto a CCD, the ultraviolet. The IXPE detectors measure the charge directly. So you have this charge trail, and you accelerate it down and amplify it onto a ASIC and measure the position and energy of the amount of charge in any particular location. telescopes themselves are very straightforward. They're exactly the same kind of telescopes that we built for the Russian experiment, where we delivered 8 telescopes a few years ago. Here we need to deliver 3, about the same number of shells. The shells are a little larger, but we've built huge shells before. That's not an issue, and it's a very straightforward development.
Any major risks for the observatory once on orbit?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I would say in this regard that nothing worries me in that respect. This is a very, very simple observatory, if you like. First of all, as I said earlier, polarization is hard. So our typical times on target are days. Our typical unit of observation was 10,000 seconds. Our typical unit observation is days. So the way this observatory works is we go and we point at a target. We take data for so many days, sometimes as much as 10 days or a few days. Then we finish taking that data and we move to the next target. Okay, and there are about 50 or 60 targets per year.
What's been the approach to target planning, and what are some of those targets?
The first year, we will plan very carefully. Since we repeat the parts of the sky every 6 months, we probably will do something like a very detailed plan for the first 6 months and a follow-up, pretty detailed plan for the second. We've left the second year totally for follow-up based on the first year results. Okay. So that as we learn, you know, this particular class of sources is not at all polarized like anybody thought, we better go look at a couple more of these. This particular class of sources is unpolarized to an incredibly tiny fraction. There's no waste time on more of them. There are several really neat things that we can do. One of them that is looking at reflected X-rays from molecular clouds near the galactic center. And that simple process, the galactic center has a black hole, emits X-rays, the X-rays go and hit one of these molecular clouds, scatter off it towards us. Now, if that's true, if what I said is true, then the polarization vector will be perpendicular to that plane, and therefore subtracting the 90 degrees, point back to the galactic center. That will prove that the galactic center was a million times more active several hundred years ago than it is today. See, people hypothesize that those X-rays are coming from the galactic center and not somewhere else, from some supernova or something like that. So that's a really neat experiment, I think. A very tough experiment. This is one of our 10-day jobbers. Sure. And we're looking at an extended object, the molecular cloud. We have to integrate over the whole thing. A lot of observing time because the flux, even though it was much stronger a million years ago, isn't that strong. Just as recently as a few hundred years ago, the galactic center was a million times more active than it is today. That tells you something about the time scale for changes of activity in supermassive black holes, which is a lot shorter than most people hypothesize. So this is a very important proof of the pudding. Now, everybody has already come to that conclusion because they see these X-rays from the molecular clouds, but they don't know where they're being scattered from. They could be scattered from some object way outside the galactic plane or somewhere else in the galactic plane or some, you know, who knows what. It's just, of course, interesting to always go to the most spectacular conclusion. So, I mean, I think this is a very important experiment. Another one that I think is extremely important is looking at something called magnetars. These are neutron stars with super strong magnetic fields, 10 to the 14th, 10 to the 15th Gauss, way above the so-called quantum mechanical critical field. And at those field strengths, there are certain quantum mechanical effects that ought to be present. And if you look at the magnetars, which are pulsed as a function of pulse phase, measure the polarization as a function of pulse phase, you can determine whether or not such effects are present. And that would verify or not verify that these fields are that strong. Another great one that we like to do is the energy dependence of polarization from a galactic X-ray black hole system like Cygnus X-1. If you measure the polarization as a function of energy, you get an effect due to the black hole spin. So by measuring the polarization dependence as a function of energy, you can measure the spin of the black hole in these systems, which is, again, very important. There are other techniques for measuring the spin, and they don't agree with it. These are some highlights of some really neat things that this experiment can do. Several supernova remnants are on our target list, and there was the imaging comes in for the bigger ones. Really comes in very handy, because not only do we measure the polarization, but we, as a averaged over the supernova remnant, we measure it as a function of position. And this is especially important in the outskirts, where we expect magnetic strong shocks and regions where particles are accelerated to very high energies, one of the sources of cosmic rays. But the polarization measurements can verify that at the energies where X-rays are being produced, where the strongest fields are, that this is really what we're seeing, and this will help us understand these regions of particle acceleration, or possibly deny them. I don't think so, because of other measurements that have been done in the radio, etc., but very important for trying to understand regions of particle acceleration. So that's another area, and we can do it as a function of position, so that's very nice too.
Are there any historical analogies for the importance of this mission?
No, I would give an analogy, probably a bad one. Analogies are always bad, sure. But the Uhuru satellite, which discovered, you know, hundreds of X-ray sources of all different types, it was to all of the work in sounding rockets before it. And this polarimetry mission is that same kind of analogy. This will put polarimetry on the map and give the theorists some meat in terms of data to work with and try to understand, predict what's going on, or explain what's going on, explain what we see or what we don't see. And it has the sensitivity to give the meaningful measurements. You know, for example, OSO-8 on all of the other bright sources gave upper limits to things, but the upper limits were in the tens of percent kind of range, and that's not very helpful. Because we can control the observing time and make this meaningful, if a target is, you know, unpolarized, we can determine that to a fraction of a percent, okay, and that's really unpolarized, not, okay, I got an upper limit of 20%, here are 80 theories that would be consistent with that. So I think it'll be tremendous. But in terms of your question about the, you know, turning it on and operating, it's the most scary part, which is only conceptually scary, is the deployment of the optical bench. Now, the optical bench, this particular design, has been built by Orbital ATK, and it's flown 51 times successfully and much longer benches than this one. This is relatively short.
Tell us a little about the mission itself.
This is an equatorial, low Earth equatorial orbit. The reason why it's equatorial is another contribution from Italy. They're providing the ground station at Malindi, which is close to the equator. And equatorial is wonderful for us because essentially we never go through the South Atlantic anomaly. So we get all the time we can take data. Of course, we get Earth occulted, and that takes away from the data taking. But still, we don't have Earth occultation and South Atlantic anomaly to contend with. So that's a plus. We have one tracking station at Malindi, and then we're using Singapore, which we would have to pay for as a backup. That's part of the NASA extended network or Earth network. But that's just our backup. Malindi is our prime, and the Italians are running that, and they send the data to Boulder. Boulder does the health and safety and the operating, the commanding, sending the commands and receiving the data, and then they send it to us, and we do the science pipeline processing, and then we send it to HESARC for archiving. Standard is exactly the same thing that's being done for NuSTAR, for SWIFT. This is very standard. And in fact, the Italian ground station is being used by both NuSTAR and SWIFT. So this is standard stuff. Headquarters has gone to a mode of what they call no exclusive use data. So we don't have any proprietary data. So Marshall will do the Science Operations Center. Laboratory for Astrophysics and Space Physics in Colorado will do the Mission Operations Center. And our science team will be prepared to analyze data as quickly as possible.
Who else is part of the larger IXP science team?
The co-investigator at McGill, Vicky Caspi, she is the co-chair of the science working group with the project scientist Steve O'Dell. Herman Marshall at MIT originally had two roles. He was the student collaboration lead and a expert in polarization. The NASA headquarters did not accept our student collaboration, so that part of his role was axed. I thought he had a very good student collaboration, but it was quote-unquote not what they wanted. And Stanford University, along with Roma Trey, Roger Romani at Stanford and Giorgio Matt at Roma Trey, are outstanding theorists, and they're going to lead our theory program. They're involved as members, as co-investigators and members of the science working group, so they can participate at their discretion in all major reviews. They participate in planning the design reference mission. That's critical. That's their part in, and they overview the calibration. And we make all of that, we will make all of that available to them to comment on.
How does working on a mission this size compare to the experience of working on a larger one?
Well, I think the general, unfortunately unrealistic statement is if we could just speed up access to space, everybody would benefit. But between the two of them, they, from a personal viewpoint, they have different levels of satisfaction. I mean, doing a mission like Chandra and having it be a tremendous success is so gratifying, it's beyond words. Being able to do a mission like IXPE where it will finish, you know, relatively speaking, very quickly, and getting it up there and seeing what it's done and having that satisfaction, you know, with it without going through years and years and years and years, also has a lot to be said for it, especially for the younger people.